Welcome to Witch Hunt, the podcast that asks how and why we hunt witches and how we can stop. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
And I'm Sarah Jack. We welcome Dr. Tabitha Stanmore.
My name is Dr. Tabitha Stanmore, and I am a research fellow at the University of Exeter, currently researching the Matthew Hopkins witch trials of the 1640s. But my PhD research was in service magic or practical magic in the late medieval, early modern period, stretching from 1350 to 1650, which is what my first academic book was about and what the book that I have coming out this year is also about. Cunning Folk, Life in the Era of Practical Magic. It comes out in May 2nd in the UK and May 28th in the US.
What exactly is service magic?
Service magic is a term that has, I suppose, it's relatively new. It's only about 10 years or so that we've been using the term service magic. And it's basically magic, practical magic that was sold to people in exchange for a fee. So it's literally what it sounds like, actually. It's something that you buy and sell. It's a commodity, but it's a supernatural commodity. Basically, it's the kind of thing that you use in order to solve everyday problems. It was something which was incredibly common for people in the medieval and early modern periods because insurance hadn't become a widespread thing at that point. A lot of people were living in a very subsisting kind of way, which meant that if you lost something that was valuable, you needed to get it back, and there weren't many other ways of doing it, and you couldn't afford to just lose something. Turning to magic and having people who had the skills to use magic in this way were very, very highly prized.
How does service magic differ from witchcraft?
That's a great question. If you asked a modern magical practitioner how they differed, I would probably expect them to say that there isn't very much difference at all, because I think with terms like cunning folk or magician or witch, they're almost synonymous in most people's minds nowadays. They are people who are wise. They're people who have supernatural powers that most people don't have access to. They're people who embrace these supernatural powers that other people fear. But in the 17th century, 16th century, 15th century, the service magicians and witches would have been seen as very, very different people. And the reason for that is because in the medieval or early modern mind, there was an idea that there are two sources, or maybe three sources of power, that you can tap into if you deal with the supernatural. The first one is religious or divine power. And that's the kind of thing that priests are using on a daily basis, because they have this incredibly powerful supernatural entity, which ultimately that's what God is. He is literally above nature, can break the laws of nature at will. And that's something that religious people, priests especially, can tap into and use in order to change the world. Cunning folk would often say that they used the same kind of power. They'd say that their spells were prayers. They're calling on the divine, or they're calling on saints to make things happen. They might also say that they were using fairies or pixies or some other kind of pseudo-natural but also supernatural entity to help them do whatever they were doing, especially if that was something like finding stolen goods. Going and asking the fairies was a very common way of finding out where your stolen spoon or your stolen horse had gone. So they're using very benign practices in order to do useful things, these cunning folk and also priests. Witches, on the other hand, were seen as people who were using dark forces to do bad, negative things. So a witch was seen as somebody who had probably sold their soul to the devil, or at least was using demonic forces. And they were using these demonic forces to do harm in some way, whether that was killing people, destroying crops, in one case, making somebody's mill fall down on a completely still day where it shouldn't have happened at all. Then all of a sudden the mill just collapses right in front of the miller. How does that happen? There is no logical explanation. It must be demonic, and it must be somebody bearing a grudge and using their demonic power to cause this harm. So there was a very clear separation in people's minds most of the time between a beneficent, cunning person and a malevolent witch. That does all get very muddied when you start looking at theologians and particularly zealous priests, and especially when you get into the Puritan movement of the late 16th and 17th centuries, where priests and very, very godly people would argue that there is no in-between. Basically, you can't have somebody who's using supernatural powers that clearly aren't being brought by God unless they are using demons. And people like George Gifford, who was a Puritan preacher living in the late 16th century, argued very strongly that nobody who claims to be able to just heal by, I don't know, just saying some words over somebody could possibly be using God's divine intervention. So they must be using demons.
When the acts against conjuration of witchcraft came in, how did that impact the service magic industry?
That's a great question. And it's super interesting because in some ways, not very much. The acts against conjuration and witchcraft, and you're right to use those terms because they're often called the witchcraft acts. And actually, witchcraft only gets mentioned in the second half of all of these acts. And the first part is very much about conjurations and practical service magic. So some of the things that service magicians would commonly be asked to do was healing, finding lost goods, treasure hunting, making people fall in love. And three out of those four things are mentioned in the acts against conjuration. Treasure hunting was seen as a massive no-no, partly because officially any gold or silver found in the ground belonged to the crown. So using magic to be able to dig this stuff up was actually stealing from the crown, which is one of the reasons I think it got mentioned in these acts. So that was very, very heavily penalized. In the first act against conjurations brought in under Henry VIII, it was actually punishable by death, as well as provoking people to unlawful love and finding lost goods and receiving money for finding lost goods through magical means is name checked as very, very bad things that people shouldn't be doing. From my own research, it doesn't look like anybody actually stopped doing any of these things as a result of this legislation. Partly, I think, because some of the law, the first law against conjurations, say under Henry VIII, was so harsh that even magistrates weren't particularly keen on prosecuting this because nobody wants to be sentenced to death for digging up a field. But also because these services were just so useful. If people don't have any other way of finding their stolen horse, then prosecuting that and stamping out that kind of service just isn't going to last very long. So, yeah, it didn't really stop anything from happening in that sense. But there is still a growing sense of concern about what sorts of powers cunning folk might have because they are lumped together in the Witchcraft and Conjurations Act with witches. And then there's that question of, oh, if you can do this kind of magic, then can you also do this negative kind of magic? So that sort of brings a cultural shift. But in terms of how often magic was practiced, it probably didn't change it very much. What I will say is that one of the other massive changes that happens in this period between 1350 and 1650 is the Reformation. So the change of the state religion from Catholicism to Protestantism or Anglicanism, as it later becomes. And that does spark a big change in magic, basically because orthodox or acceptable Catholic practices all of a sudden become seen as superstition. Appealing to saints, using prayers to heal, that kind of thing, they all start being seen as quite suspicious under Protestant doctrine. At that point, you start seeing priests potentially who were doing perfectly orthodox things 5 years ago, suddenly being seen as potential magicians who are using their nefarious knowledge to form spells and possibly being in league with the devil as a result of that, because obviously there's a very heavy idea among different Protestant sects that Catholics are actually in league with the devil. So that's a really interesting way that the kind of religion suddenly becomes sacrilege and therefore possibly magic, at least in the eyes of some people.
What are some other primary uses of service magic?
Healing is definitely the most common by a long way. And again, before we started recording, we mentioned that everybody on this call currently has a cold. And they don't seem to be going anywhere. And that's obviously true of all of history, right? There's always been sickness. There's always been annoying illnesses that can't be shifted or life-threatening diseases. And especially before the advent of things like antibiotics or vaccines, there is a sort of an endemic sickness among the population. So And medicine isn't particularly effective a lot of the time. It's very good at treating symptoms. It's not necessarily very good at treating disease. So turning to magic, again, kind of makes a lot of sense in that situation, especially when you're using prayer spells. So you're very much appealing to a higher power to say, St. Justinian, for example, please cure my toothache. It might be the only thing that works, frankly. So healing was incredibly common. That was one of the things that cunning folk were asked to do the most. Another one was protection. Protection in battle, protection for sailors when they are out at sea, to protect them from storms. And I think the most touching one is the amount that magic was used in love spell, right? Well, in situations about spells used for love, whether that's making people fall in love with each other or actually breaking people up potentially because you're so in love with somebody and they got to marry somebody else. What are you going to do about that? It's probably a spell that you can use to break that couple up so that you can get that person. And yeah, again, that's a very, very common use, which was very lightly prosecuted a lot of the time because a lot of the time, love magic, it's about community cohesion. It's about keeping people together, especially the number of spells that are often directed at making a husband and wife get along better, whether that's making the husband less cantankerous or making the wife fall in love with her husband again. Those kinds of things, they were often available and very simple spells a lot of the time, which kind of, again, I think shows quite how common they must have been. There's one woman in the 15th century who apparently used to wash her husband's shirts in holy water because apparently that made him meek and pliable for the rest of the week. And she must have heard that spell from somewhere. She was also sharing it with her neighbors and passing on that knowledge, which I guess isn't so much service magic, but it is a very obvious use of magic that people needed. And I don't know how many people took up her advice, but she certainly seemed to think it would work and had been doing it for years by the time she finally got reported to the authorities as potentially not using holy water in the way it was intended.
One of the uses you talk about is divination. What are some of the key methods used to divine?
One of my favorite forms of divination, which sounds deeply impractical, but I love, is the bread and knives method. And that's basically where you take a loaf of bread and you stick two knives into the sides of the loaf in a cross shape. And then you put a peg in the top of the loaf. And then you turn it upside down and then you hold the peg between your hands and you ask a yes or no question. And basically the bread will spin one way for no and one way for yes. More common versions of the same basic principle are the seven shears, which is, again, lots of different methods, but basically you take a pair of kind of sheep shearing shears or large scissors and put a sieve on top of those and then ask questions once the sieve is balanced on the top. And again, the sieve will tilt one way for yes, one way for no. And this is much more practical. You're not going to destroy a loaf of bread every time you attempt it. And you're also going to be able to, pretty much anybody will be able to use this method because everybody would probably own a pair of shears and everybody would own a sieve. The fancier version of this divination method is the book and key. And that is one that pretty much only priests used or people who had a very high level of education because it would use either a Psalter or a Bible. And you'd place a big heavy key inside of the book. And you'd hold the book in between your two balled fists. And then you would ask your question. And often if it was finding stolen goods that you were trying to find out with this method, then you would start by saying something like, by St. Peter and St. Paul, Tony's stolen my horse. And if the key fell out, then that would be the right answer. But yeah, as I say, this is something that only some people will be able to do because not everybody had access to printed works and especially not something as sacred as a Bible. And that's by St. Peter and St. Paul, you're definitely summoning divine intervention to make this work. Again, condemned by the church, but still used by the church. And again, a simpler method of that is just taking your Bible and just opening it at a random page. And the first line from the gospel that you see is the answer to your question. Which some would call that just basic religion or just guesswork, but people would definitely see it as a very reliable form of divination, depending on the answer.
Thank you for listening to Witch Hunt. Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.